Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, full house today. Is there room for all of you back there? Is there anybody sitting on anyone else's shoulders? Or all right, can you hear me okay? Okay, just give me a high sign if you can't hear. So, it's just good to be together. Isn't it the beginning of April? A new spring starting, all of us here together at Zen Center on a Sunday morning. And it's even sunny. All right. So we're here together, all of us, at Zen Center today because we suffer. If you look deeply into your life and follow the breadcrumb trail, you'll figure out that the actual reason you're here today is because you suffer. We were fortunate to have Norman Fisher, some of you know the name, a contemporary American Zen teacher, in our community with us this past weekend. He was here for several days doing some teaching downtown and doing some teaching here at Zen Center and at another Zen Center across town. And Norman Fisher says, we have religion because we die. That sounds about right, doesn't it? We have religion because we die. We're here today because we suffer. And if I ask myself if that's true, I'd think, well, what are the things I do at Zen Center? Why am I motivated to practice? What brought me there in the first place? Would I be doing any of those things if I never had experienced suffering? And if I never was going to die, no. Those are the fuel for practice. Those of us who are familiar with Buddhist thought, Buddhist teaching, know this is very much in keeping with what we've learned. It's the first noble truth of the Buddha, the universality of suffering. In fact, humans are born into this as part of our collective inheritance, as the experience of dissatisfaction, dis-ease, struggle, constriction, resistance, whatever you want to call that. Because we suffer, we're motivated to do certain things. So Katagiri Roshi says, our zazen, our meditation practice, is a chosen position of vulnerability. Zazen is a chosen position of vulnerability. And he also says, zazen is giving yourself to yourself. Zazen is giving yourself to yourself. These are two of my very favorite quotes by Katagiri Roshi, and a lot of you have heard me say them many times. They've turned out to be two of my favorites just because they didn't make sense to me when I first heard them. They were kind of a koan, in a sense. And it took them a while to lodge in my heart, lodge in my chest, and start to teach me things. And when I take these two things together, I'm really puzzled, aren't I? My meditation is a chosen position of vulnerability, and I'm giving myself to myself. That's interesting. Like, what's he talking about? Where is the gift in feeling vulnerable? I usually equate feeling content and safe and protected with being given a gift. I've got this gift for you. It's feeling super insecure and vulnerable. Not a very good. I don't recommend that for birthdays, anniversaries, Christmas. I don't. It's interesting, though. That's the teaching, isn't it? That's the teaching. So that's what I want to explore today in this talk. I want to explore those ideas with you. And my entry point is I'm just going to tell you a quick story. When I wrote this talk, I wrote down 6 weeks ago. It's now more like 2 months ago. But it's about 2 months ago. And my wife and I are running an errand. And while we're driving across town on 494, I see a dead fawn in the median of the freeway. So first, and for those of you who are fans of the skandhas or who know about the skandhas or are learning the skandhas, there's a little overlap here. First, I see it. That's skandha number one. It's form. It's just physically the consciousness of the eye recognizing something. Right? I see it. Then I identify. Well, what is that? Oh, it's a fawn. Now I recognize I recognize that. That's actually the third skanda. I'm perceiving it. I'm beginning to create an idea about it. Then I feel pain, horror, sadness, the things we feel when we see something like that. Then I looked away. I like physically moved my eyes off of it and looked elsewhere because I didn't want to see it. I didn't want that to be true, so I looked away. Then I immediately thought of my wife who was driving, and I asked her some sort of question that would relate to her looking to the right so she wouldn't see the fawn. Isn't that interesting? I tried to distract her. I want to protect her from this. Then I feel angry. Now my feeling is beginning to change. Now I feel angry at whoever hit that little deer. Why are you driving so fast? Now I'm angry at humans in general. Why do we need these machines? Why do we need these freeways? Why is 70 miles an hour so important? Then I did some problem solving. You know, this whole stretch doesn't have a fence. There's woods right there. How come we can't, you know, this is Eden Prairie or wherever the heck I was, Bloomington. Surely they have enough money for a chain link fence. Why can't we have a fence here that would prevent this from happening? Then I got distracted. I wonder what the best route to actually get to the store is. And do we need bread, too? Should I add that to the list? I think we forgot bread. Right? So I pieced all this stuff together after the fact. But all of this happened in the space of 20 seconds? I don't know. This is the nature of our experience, right? Incredibly layered, incredibly dense. Bingo. So, it all takes place in a few seconds, but you begin to see the progression, right? The progression is from immediate awareness and immediate response, physically and emotionally, to secondary emotion, caretaking for my wife, anger, the things that cover those first feelings very, very nicely, to some escapes, angry stories, problem solving, and then finally to just distraction and ignoring. Should we get bread? I'm a lot more comfortable now, aren't I? I've forgotten the whole thing. In the space of 30 seconds or a minute, it's just a memory. So my experience goes from immediate to abstract. It goes from felt, physical, and emotional truth to mental abstraction and distancing. It goes from remembering to forgetting. Does that make sense? Do you see the kind of progression there? So this is our experience all the time. This is a very common human experience. That's why I'm choosing this really small little 30-second story. This is just a nice encapsulation of this dynamic that's happening all the time for us. So fast forward about 3 days later, I'm sitting at home and I'm working on some emails or something. I got my headphones on. I'm listening there to Lady Gaga. Start crying out of nowhere. I just start crying. And I'm like, what? What's going on? And because I'm at home, I'm doing my work from home, I actually have the freedom to turn off the radio, turn down the email, and just go, what's going on? I'm going to drop my awareness into my physical sensations of being alive and into my emotion body. I'm just going to go into that feeling and figure out what's going on. Right? Lady Gaga is not making me cry. There's something else going on, right? So I go into it. I'm just really quiet. I go into it. I do the practice. This is the practice we're taught to do. Where is your body? Where is your breath? Where is the feeling? Where is your body? Where is your breath? Where is the feeling? Right? No more abstractions. Follow the root. Go to the root. Go to the real thing. And it takes about 30 seconds before it comes back to me. Oh, right. That's why this hurts. I'm remembering that fawn from 3 days ago. I never felt that. I never processed that. I didn't give it a chance on the stage of my life. I was so quick to go to distraction, so quick to go to my defenses against that experience, I didn't allow it in. And of course, it's in there. I had that experience. It is in there. And this is the chance it had to come up. So I go back into the feeling. And I go back into the image. And then, of course, the experience reveals itself to me in its entirety. And I see and I remember, oh, that little fawn was dead. And I know it died alone, on asphalt, in terror, not knowing where it was, not knowing how it got there, far from its mother, far from anything that made sense. It didn't know what those oncoming lights were. It didn't know what that sound was. It was getting louder and louder. Bang. That's the experience I was trying to not have, right, by going into my defenses. So when I remember all of it, of course, I just sat with the feeling. It was terrible. I cried. I felt really sad. And then it passed. I allowed it its time. It passed. It was a very human response to a very human situation, a very real world situation. Happens a lot. And after I felt that and allowed it through, it passed. My heart got lighter. Went back to my emails. Went back to Lady Gaga. That's the practice. So, I want to be clear about one thing before I move on. The remembering of the detail of, like, oh, the image, the fawn, is less important here than remembering. And when I say remembering, I'm talking about, like, reconnecting with something, to take a member, like an arm, and to reattach it, to bring it back in. What's less important is the specifics of the memory. Oh, this is about a fawn. What's more important are the other two parts of memory, which are the feeling, the emotion, the heartbreak, the horror, the sadness, and then the body sensations, the felt sensations. When we're exposed to something horrific, we feel it in our bodies, right? Our hearts get tight, our breath gets shallow, usually our shoulders go up, the back of the neck, however that shows up for you, maybe your gut clenches. That physical response is still stored in our body. So in that moment, what I'm trying to remember most of all is the physical sensations tied in with that. The physical sensations and then the emotion. And if a story emerges and I actually have a specific memory, oh yeah, this is about that fawn 3 days ago, great. Right? That's consciousness. That's the fifth skanda. It's a wonderful storyteller. That's important too, but it's actually less important than the physical, right? And the emotional. That's why when you're working with somebody and you've got a bad memory and you have the storyline, but you haven't connected with where it is in your body and you haven't connected with the feelings, you're not done yet. There's not work there yet. It's just a story to you. It's like watching a movie, right? But it is stored in you. So that's why that was important for me to do. So I just want to be clear about that. The narrative is important. It's fine, but it's actually less. And if in that moment the only thing I did was get in touch with the fact that I felt really sad, and I didn't know why, but I was in touch with it in my body, and I was in touch with the feelings, that would have been fine. The fact I was able to remember it was about a little fawn, that's helpful too, but it's less important than the very physical dimensions of our experience. So the reason I'm talking about this today, the reason this is helpful, is because in that moment, those 30 seconds of experience, again, I went from a direct experience, horror, sadness, pain, to beginning to distance myself, to beginning to defend myself, to beginning to insulate myself. That experience gets farther and farther away. It becomes more and more abstract, and I've got some nice, comfortable, self-satisfied anger about it. Or I've got a nice solution. I'm going to put up a fence. Maybe I will actually put up a fence. Good for me. What's important for me to know, though, is I have to know what's motivating what it is I'm going to do. I have to know what's motivating my actions. I have to know what's motivating my speech, my action, and my livelihood, to use three of the Eightfold Path. And for the most part, most of us, most of the time, are actually motivated by defenses against experience. I don't want to feel the pain. I want to stay in the comfortable anger. I want to stay in the problem solving. In fact, I'm so codependent, I don't even want my wife to see it, because her seeing it would make me uncomfortable. All this is defenses, 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 defenses from something actually happening. Do you see what I mean? We go into autopilot just that fast. So one of the wonderful, fantastic, beautiful things about Zazen, about our meditation practice here, is we get to physically stop moving. So I want to say slow down, but it's more than slow down. You physically stop, and you watch the nature of your experience arise from moment to moment, and you see this happening. There's an uncomfortable storyline. Ooh, what's that about? Where is that in my body? Where is that in my emotion? What is this a defense against? Oh, I wish my posture were like her. Oh, what's the feeling there? Do I feel inadequate? What's that about? Where is that in my body? Where is that in my emotion? I don't want to live in my defenses against reality. I want to live in reality, my experience of reality. And our meditation here gives us this fantastic opportunity to peel, right? Peel away all the automatic stuff. Peel away the autopilot. Peel away those top layers of ego defenses and actually see, feel, experience, taste, touch what's actually happening. It's beautiful. If I'm in my defenses, I can't be as helpful as I would be. I can't be as helpful. Because when I'm operating out of my defenses, I'm trying to take care of myself. I'm only trying to guard myself against my own experience. Does that make sense? Why I tried to distract my wife, why I was angry about people owning cars, why I wanted to put up a fence. All that was about, I don't want to experience the thing I just experienced. None of that was actually coming from a helpful place. It was all coming from a place about, how do I not feel this right now? Does that make sense? I could have done all those very same actions from a place of connection, compassion, and love too, right? It's just about seeing the thing that motivates. Seeing the thing that motivates. So, I'm calling in the shards. On the cushion, I'm calling in the shards there when I'm at home, and I turn off my music, and I drop my emails, and I just am paying attention. I'm bringing something back in. I'm allowing myself to be pierced. I'm allowing myself to remember. This is what Katagiri is talking about, a chosen position of vulnerability. Please don't defend yourself against your life. Let yourself be pierced by it. Let yourself be permeable. Let it in, let it in, let it in. Our hearts get stronger. They get more resilient, don't they? When we do this kind of stuff, don't they? Just every time they get a little bigger, a little stronger. Right? A little more resilient. That's how that muscle gets stronger. Not by protecting it and making sure nothing bad ever happens to it. It's the opposite. It's the opposite. Let it in. That heart is big enough. That heart is strong enough. You can trust it. It'll hold this. So, I'm choosing to not anesthetize. And if nothing else, Zen practice, Buddhist practice, is about not anesthetizing. Really allowing our life in all the way. The word Buddha means awake. The word Buddha means awake. Not asleep. Right? Awake. That means open, connected. Not clever. And insulated and defended. Right? When we imagine the archetype of the Buddha, do we imagine somebody who is really defended? Who's really closed? Who's really clever? Who would always have a pithy thing to say to you that would distance you from him? I hope not. I mean, maybe that's your picture. I guess that's fine too. But, like, no, I imagine somebody who is tremendously permeable, feels it all, sees it all, right? Sees and feels it all. That's the chosen position of vulnerability. And this is where the gift part comes. This is where the gift part comes. And the sad part for me is that I see a lot of folks, and this was myself included at the beginning of Zazen practice. I discovered Zen in my early 20s, and I stopped after maybe 6 months. I don't remember. But after about 6 months or so, I thought, eh, forget it. Screw it. I'm not into it. I know why now I quit, because I had an idea of like what it was supposed to do for me. And it wasn't doing those things. I mean, I wasn't able to levitate, for one thing. And I wasn't impermeable. I wanted to be impermeable. When I read stories about enlightenment, I thought, oh, I get it. That's the thing you get that makes you impermeable. You just don't hurt anymore. Nothing hurts anymore. That sounds pretty sweet, doesn't it? That's why I'm here at Zen Center, because I suffer. I don't want to suffer anymore. There's this thing called enlightenment that you get, and you arrive at this place, and you just stop hurting. You're brilliantly wise and endlessly compassionate, and just stuff doesn't hurt no more. Wow, the best armor in the world. I totally misunderstood what we did. I totally misunderstood the path of the boat. I totally misunderstood it, so I quit. That's honest. It wasn't giving me what I wanted. All I really had learned in those 6 months or whatever it was of Zazen was like how quickly I get bored, how much boredom hurts, how dissatisfied I am most of the time. You know. And I didn't have a teacher then. I didn't have a sangha. Because if I had had a teacher or a sangha, they would have said, fantastic, good. That's exactly what's supposed to be happening. Stick with it. Those are your defenses. Keep looking at them. They're going to go away after a while. And you're going to be nice and open. But unless somebody's there to support you, you know what I mean? You have ideas about what it's supposed to look like, and that isn't showing up, so you quit. So I did quit. And I came back. I'm lucky I came back. But I see a lot of folks who do pick up meditation practice because they're interested or because it's fascinating or there's some sort of shine there for them. That's wonderful, wonderful. Anything that gets you in the door is wonderful. But what makes me feel sad is I oftentimes experience them leaving, quitting, giving up the practice before they get the gift. They experience a little taste of the, oh, this is a chosen position of vulnerability, and I don't want it, so I'm out of here. It takes a while for us to really understand that when Katagiri said, it's giving yourself to yourself, That's the vulnerability. It's a gift. It's exactly what you need. It's more aliveness. It's more awakeness. If they don't see that, there wouldn't be a reason for them to stay. And so they leave. And I get that. Meditation is not always comfortable. Zazen is not always comfortable. It doesn't make you bulletproof. And when we go into those difficult areas, that really is why we need each other, why we need friends, why we need teachers, why we need Sangha, why we need Dharma talks and books to reinforce, to remind us, to support us. We're doing this together. Yes, that's a good sign. Good. You're feeling it more deeply. Good. So, Zazen practice from a Zen point of view, from our point of view, the way we do it here, is very much about dropping our defenses from the real, turning toward what is real. We always say we turn toward suffering in Buddhism, which is true. We turn toward joy, though, too. So the example I use today is a painful example of an afflictive emotion, but it goes for the positive ones, too. It even goes for the neutral ones. It goes for all of them, but it's about allowing them all more deeply. And at one point, I don't know, this would have been years ago, during a Dharma talk, during a retreat, Tim said something that really helped me. He said, I must have needed to hear this at that time, but he said, you know, Zen practice is here to make you more human, not less human. And I think I still had vestiges of that. When I arrive at the enlightenment place or the whatever that looks like, the ordination place or the shuso place or the transmission place or the I get to sit on the brown cushion place, then I will, and really to fill in the blank, it would have been I will be less human somehow. I'll be able to regard your suffering and my suffering from a comfortable distance. Won't that be nice? A nice pink cloud of wisdom will just surround me, and that'll just be a nice thing, and you can knock, and maybe I'll peer out at you. Right? I'll be so comfortable then. I really needed him to say, no, it makes you more human. And I think it's because I was going through a period in practice when my heart was just breaking all the time. Remember those AT&T long-distance commercials that was always like the father calling the son at college or whatever, and they're really manipulative and saccharine and awful? And I would always cry at those. Oh, God, it's so beautiful. I'd be like, Tim, what's going on with me? I'm crying for dead squirrels. I'm crying for AT&T long-distance commercials. I go to Hallmark, and I'm useless. I'm just cracking open. I can't control it. I can't keep it closed when I want it closed. I can't tell it to open and have it open. It's just, and he was like, oh, this is fantastic. Good. Good. You're waking up, aren't you? What do you think? Are you more permeable to joy, too? And I was like, well, yeah. More permeable to sadness, to heartbreak? Well, yeah. Good. You're becoming more human. You're becoming more human. Do you think somehow the idea is to not have feelings anymore, or to somehow float above them, or somehow stay safe? No, being human is incredibly dangerous. You should make it more dangerous. Get closer to those things you're scared of. Go into that cave. Absolutely. Let yourself cry at the stupid commercial. Good. You feel sad? That means you're recognizing that you're sad, and you're letting it happen. Wow, that sounds like courage. That sounds like resiliency. That sounds like awareness. That sounds like connection and engagement. Doesn't it? Instead of, oh, I feel nothing. What a poorly made. It's like, your heart's constricted and your throat is tight, but mustn't cry. That sounds like my childhood. That's not what I'm here to do. And that's our zazen. And that's why the broken heart is the gift. Broken means open. Broken means open. The quote on the program today is from, some of you know, Hazrat Inayat Khan. He's a, he's not contemporary anymore. He's dead, but a Sufi, a brilliant, brilliant Sufi teacher in the Sufi tradition. And he says, God breaks the heart again and again until it stays open. God breaks the heart again and again until it stays open. Maybe in our tradition we would say that. Maybe we would say practice breaks the heart again and again. Compassion breaks the heart open again and again. Love breaks the heart open. Joy breaks it open too, doesn't it? When you're feeling joyous and your heart wide open. It doesn't matter what word we use, but he's pointing to something really, really important. Really, really important there. It's why we put so much emphasis on compassion in Mahayana Buddhism. The open heart. The broken heart is, that's where our connection is. That's where our healing takes place. That's the reason I'm able to relate to you. It's the reason I'm able to love you. If I had never suffered, I couldn't even have a relationship with you. it's actually impossible to conceive of what my experience would be like if I had never suffered, but I sure would not be able to relate to you. It's our common human experience. Of course I need that to crack me open so we can connect. Now there's not a distance between us. Oh, cracks me open again so I can connect with you. Do you guys have that sense when your heart cracks open? Like, as much as this sort of is hard right now, as much as I don't like this, this is real. That some part of you actually kind of rejoices and goes, this is real. Crying over a dead fawn on the freeway, that's real. Ignoring it, pretending I don't care, rationalizing it, that's not real. And I'm really good at doing it. And I do it 90% of the time, but that's not human, is it? And it's interesting to think, had I showed up at work that day and been like, wow, I'm really upset. What happened? Oh, I saw a dead fawn on the freeway. I probably would have been ashamed of saying that. I probably would have been ashamed of saying that, wouldn't I have? Oh, I don't want you to think that I care about stuff. Like, what? Isn't that weird? I would regard that vulnerability as weakness. I'm not showing you my vulnerability. I'm not showing you my strength, my resiliency. I'm still pierced by the fact that little deer died alone. That still matters to me. I'm still engaged in this life. I still care. I'm still awake. I'm still raw. I'm still pierceable. And I'd probably go into my defense and say, oh, yeah, you know, I don't know, da-da-da. I heard something on NPR, da-da-da. I'd distract from that. Isn't that interesting? I'd be ashamed of that. Wow, when I recognize that, I've got some work to do. I really have some work to do. That's why Zazen's so helpful to me. It shows me the truth of my experience so clearly. So in the Pali Canon and the Satipatthana Sutra, everything we're talking about today, all of it the Buddha refers to as mindful awareness of bodily sensations and emotion. Right? Mindful awareness of bodily sensations and emotion. It's amazing how often that comes up in the traditional scripture. Mindful awareness of bodily sensations and emotion. Where is it in your body? How does it feel emotionally? Where is it in your body? How does it feel emotionally? Well, I think that... No. Where is it in your body? How does it feel emotionally? We're not here to feed those things, but we're not here to distance ourselves. And the teaching is so important because we're just so good at distancing ourselves. And we're so good to going into, how do I build a fence here? How do I distract my wife from this? How do I make sure we come home a really efficient way? Do we need bread? We're really good at that. Blah, 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 blah. Fifth skanda, really, really good at chatter. He's wanting us to go back to the source of the suffering because that's where the transformation takes place. Right? Distracting myself from the crying baby does not help the crying baby, and it doesn't help me. So attention to, getting closer to crying baby, that will help me and the crying baby. That's why he comes back to this so many times. And in our tradition, and a lot of traditions now, because compassion is such a mainstream word, when we first hear about compassion, it's easy for us to create an abstraction of what that is, of how that looks, to kind of idolize the quality of compassion and to imagine that it's going to show up as someone else offering us their broken heart and us being very kind and expansive and holding their pain with our kind awareness. And that happens. That does happen, and it's beautiful when it does. But more often, at least in my experience, more often it shows up as having this broken heart splashing inside of my chest right now, offering me its pain, needing my kind awareness, needing for me to include it, to heal it. And the truth is, we just generally ignore it completely. We generally ignore it. We shut it off, we shut it down, we cover it, we distract ourselves. I don't want to include this one. And that's interesting, isn't it? But we all seem to have this. So please, don't use your spiritual practice, whatever it is, don't use it as a distraction. Right? Don't try to bypass the real. Don't try to get away from the mucky work. Especially don't do this in the service of some lofty, abstract spiritual idea like enlightenment or compassion and how you imagine that might look. Because where the rubber meets the road is where the work really is here. This broken heart, this mucky set of memories and half-remembered impulses and emotions and stirrings in the body and confusion and cloudiness, that's where the work is. That's where the work is. I can't possibly help teach you to swim until I've learned to swim. I can't possibly offer you compassion until it's coming from a place of clarity in me, right? Otherwise, all I'm trying to do is build another fence, and the whole time all I'm trying to really do is get away from my experience. Your anxiety hurts me. So the work is always here. And it does show up in the way we don't like. I appreciate this is tough, tough work, because it is the work. But the compassion practice shows up in the form of, you know, the dead fawn on the way to work, or the angry coworker, or the feeling of shame when I debate whether or not to tell someone about it, or your sullen teenage kid, or your disconnected spouse, or your angry neighbor, or whatever. There's the front lines. There's the experience. And the experience happens, and you experience emotion, and then you maybe cover it with problem solving, and maybe do all the things that I outlined. And the practice is to catch yourself when you're doing it, to do it on the cushion, go back, what's happening, how do I feel, where is it in my body, to call those things back in again, shine the light of awareness on them. These practices that they teach us in the tradition of Tonglen and Metta and that kind of stuff, they're meant to be done in real time, on the mucky front lines. They're meant to be done in the safety of the cushion on the refuge of the Zen Center too, right? They're valuable no matter when you do them. But what I'm encouraging you to do is to not let them be too abstract for too long. Let them show up in the heat of the moment, in the muck of the moment, in the dirt of the moment. That's where they're the most effective. So if you are looking to do compassion practice, and you should be, because we're here because we suffer. That's what our practice is for. If you're looking to do a compassion practice, just remind yourself this morning of how many opportunities you have. Perhaps remind yourself of how close to you suffering is. We have a tendency as humans, at least I do, to even conceptualize and distance myself from the idea of suffering and think, oh, that'll happen later when my wife dies. That'll be suffering. When my car is stolen, my house burns down, that will be a thing called suffering. And when that happens, I'll know it. It's far down the road, and I'm developing a skill set now so that I'll know how to deal with that skillfully when it happens. When I get my cancer diagnosis, that will be suffering. You know, it's later. It's later. Isn't it always later? And it's never later. So if we're looking for opportunities to do compassion practice, remind yourself how close it is. Right, there's a broken heart sitting in the middle of the chest of the person sitting to your left. There's a broken heart sitting in the middle of the chest of the person sitting to your right. There's a broken heart sitting right in the middle of your chest. Right now, that's how close it is. And if you want to know where to start your compassion practice, that last one. Start there. Start there. And if today, on this Sunday morning, your heart isn't feeling broken, wonderful. Don't worry, give it time. Don't worry. And if you can't see that, if you can't see that your heart is already open, your heart is already broken, do zazen. Do zazen. That brokenness will show up. It will show up. And you begin to see it as the gift. You will begin to see it as your strength. The brokenness shows up, you see it as such, and then you realize, oh, brokenness open. The openness of my heart is already here. It shows up. I promise it will. It shows up, it shows up, it shows up. And if that's difficult, if that's too raw, if that's too close, that's fine. That's fine too. We always need something to do now. So if you can't do that with your heart in zazen right now, then start this morning with joining us for tea, coffee this morning after the talk, and hold your teacup really carefully today. Hold your teacup. It's no different than your heart. It's exactly as alive. It's exactly as part of your experience. It's exactly as included in your mind as all of your ideas about broken heart. And if you hold it like it's alive, like it matters, like it's included in your life, won't something be more awake in you? Won't you be more vulnerable to your experience as a result of that? Won't there be a connection there instead of a distancing? Isn't that your life? Isn't your life showing up that way right then? Wow. That experience of teacup, or right now of cloth against skin, or of sensations of breath, is exactly as real as the texture of emotion that's always arising and changing, the texture of thought that's arising and changing. All these things. It's just funny how quickly we are to reify thought and to negate the rest. Right? My sensation of cloth against skin doesn't matter, but my ideas about reality, they really matter, because I've got a big frontal cortex and I'm kind of hot about it. right? My ideas about my life are so much more important. What you do for a living is so much more important than how you feel. Have you ever asked anybody, how do you feel? And they usually say, well, I think. Do it. Do it at a family gathering just to be a troublemaker. Oh, how are you feeling, Mom? Well, you know, the rock and roll, that's the problem. Well, okay, that's great, but that's not a feeling. We don't even know what's going on down here. It's a huge part of our experience. How's the cloth feeling against your skin today, Mom? How do your feet feel against the stable earth? You know, we never think to ask those things. It's always thoughts, thoughts, thoughts. And our thoughts are important, too. They're very, very important. But our unquestioned belief in the primacy of our thoughts, above all else, that's where we get in trouble. It's a fantastic, what do they say? It's a brain is a wonderful servant and a terrible master. I believe that. When that brain is serving the heart, it is a very powerful, very helpful thing. But when everything else is serving that, because it distances us. It can distance us so easily. It can distance ourselves from our experience of being alive. So, I'll wrap up here. There's a book on Zen practice by James Ford called If You're Lucky, Your Heart Will Break. If you're lucky, your heart will break. And that's all I'm really saying this morning. And I think that's true. I think choosing vulnerability, choosing an awake, aware, open, broken heart is infinitely preferable to choosing an asleep, closed, unaware heart. If you're ever given the choice between those two things, please pick the broken one. I know it feels vulnerable. I know it feels scared. I know it involves letting down your armor. I know it involves making you more permeable. I know. But we're really talking about being awake and being alive, or being asleep and being dead. And that's what Buddhism's about, awake. Buddha means awake. Awake, vulnerable, open, undefended. Undefended. And so when you experience pain, when you experience suffering, when you experience that horror at the dead fawn on the freeway, I invite you to feel it. I invite you to let it in. I invite you to cry about it. I invite you to tell your coworkers, I'm crying because I saw a dead fawn on the freeway. And the reason I'm inviting you to do that, of course, is because it's practice. It's our practice. But it also means, in a larger sense, it means you still care. It means you still care. You're still alive. Life still matters to you. You're not dead yet. You're not a flatliner. You're engaged. This matters. My life matters. The fawn matters. This feeling matters. I'm still engaged. I still care. I'm still alive. And if that's true for you, congratulations. Sincerely, congratulations. You're really, really lucky. That's what practice is for. That's why we do this. So I thank you. I thank you for your attention this morning. Thank you. We still have some time. So if anybody has any comments or questions or similar experiences you'd like to offer briefly, that'd be wonderful. We have several announcements today, so I'm going to make sure to allow them enough time. But if you've got something you'd like to share, it'd be nice to hear other voices. Laura.
I just wanted to say thanks for the reframe of your emotions, you know. I think a lot of people are told growing up that you're too sensitive or whatever, so we need to reparent a little bit. And maybe by doing this, you can be an example for other people that it's okay to really experience all the range of your emotions.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks. I like reparent. That's what it feels like. I tried to kill them, but they wouldn't go away. So I'm incredibly lucky. Please, Pat.
There's also a great joy in that openness and that vulnerability that comes with, yeah, with that. That's going to be the reciprocal of that.
Yeah. Isn't that true? Did you guys hear what he said there? He said there's also real joy. The openness goes both ways, doesn't it? I mean, open to joy. That's why we love joy, because it opens us. It's an open-hearted moment. Laughter does that. Love does that, of course. So does grief. But yeah, there's a huge joy. And the tricky part, you know, for me at least at the beginning with this, like to use the fawn example, was seeing the joy. And I realized that deer life was part of my experience for maybe 15 seconds. But the only alternative to feeling the pain and the sadness of its death was to feel nothing and to make it essentially a non-entity. And by choosing, oh, I'm really sad that you died, there was one person, at least, that witnessed the death and grieved for it. And there's actually, you're right, exactly right, Pat. That's wonderfully said. There's a great, like, I recognize we're both alive together. We both feel vulnerable. I'm really sad. There's actually a deep joy there. Happy might not be the right word, but it's kind of like, it's kind of the weird joy you get at a funeral. There's a weird joy at a funeral to celebrate somebody's life and to just have your heart be wide open and raw and you hurt like hell, but there's something so real about it that you're like, this is actually humans at their best. This is actually an expression of joy. You know, instead of what we might want to do to get away from that. Yeah, thank you, Pat. Does that make sense to folks? Could you hear? Okay. Anything else today? Steve?
What about equanimity?
Equanimity. Oh. Well, that's a great question. I think that was one of the traps. That's a great question, Steve. I think one of the traps I fell into early, I still fall into this one, is imagining equanimity. Do you guys know the word equanimity? It's one of the immeasurables. We talk about it a lot in Buddhism. You know, this sort of uprightness, non-swayedness, you know, the resisting the three temptations. I'm not going to lean toward the thing I want more of. I won't lean away from the thing I want less of. I'm going to stay upright. I think I imagined for a long time that that was like stationary, that it was like a fixed point you arrived at and then I was unmoved by life. I think it fed my ideas about what enlightenment were, to be unmoved. But in Mahayana Buddhism, our ideal is compassion, which means to get closer to be with suffering. And I started realizing that equanimity is like balance, and it isn't a fixed point. It's swaying and moving, and it's more like the kind of balance that a dancer has. When they're all the way to the right, then they're all the way to the left, and they're in the middle, and then they're still and they're in motion, and it's just shh. Because my fear was, if equanimity to me means nothing means anything to me, that's not me being more human. That's me being shut down. And the only thing that would motivate me to ever want to be that, if I'm really honest with myself, is I'm scared. I don't want to hurt. And fear doesn't motivate enlightenment. Enlightenment isn't about fear. The Buddha is a fearless character. So like to be pierced by grief or pain, why would he be scared of that? He wouldn't be. So I kind of imagine equanimity is more of a moving target. To use Laura's example, like I'm open and receptive to feelings means I'm crying on the way to work because I saw a dead fawn. I allow it. I see it. It passes through me. I get to work. I tell a friend about it. She tells me this hilarious joke about the interrupting cow. And now I'm laughing and I'm full of joy and I allow that too. And so it is a dance. Like, yeah, I'm swaying to the right, I'm feeling grief. Now I'm swaying to the left, I'm feeling joy. And now I'm puzzled, and now I'm, right? It's the dynamism of Zazen, I think. It's being able to, it's the Daruma doll. You can't, like weebles. In this country, weebles. They wobble, but they don't fall down. You always fall, you fall, find your way back up again. You find your way back up again. Yeah. The heavy little kid's toy that rolls around but never. And I think of that. There's equanimity. Equanimity is the base of that. You know, I don't think of it as a stationary thing. I think of it as a moving. I don't know if that's helping at all, but that's a great, great question, Dean.
I was just wondering, how does like right view and maybe knowledge of like the things that are unknowable, the four, whatever, those things that are always around here in our awareness that we might be reacting to and having all these feelings about, that maybe if we have the right view about them, we can saw through things in the best way. That's one of the, you know, precepts. And awesome, you know, some teachers say it might be the first priority, the right view.
Yes.
Because then you might, you know, as a way to kind of organize it. But, because, you know, I don't think, you know, I think it's part of one of the postmodern traps is maybe some good preference to feeling. The more you feel it, the more spiritual you are.
Oh, yes.
I don't, you know, that's one of the pitfalls on the path here. So,
yes.
You know, there's other things going on in life where I don't want to necessarily feel micro focus on my full spectrum of my feelings. So I have a full spectrum of consciousness. There's a whole bunch of other bands of things going on. How do I make sure I'm aware of all of this?
Yep. That's a great, great question. Great, great question. Yeah, I'm guessing, and this is honestly a guess, but I'm guessing the reason the emphasis was put in the early stuff on bodily sensations and emotions is because that's the quickest thing we ignore. As humans, we just get really, really good at ignoring both those things. we get stuck on the idea that I am my thoughts are real, I live inside my head, you know. So to emphasize the opposite makes sense. But also, because a lot of these teachings come from the Satipatthana Sutra, and we're talking about mindfulness, which is by definition non-egoic awareness, right, non-preferential awareness, it would never, when practiced correctly, it would never lean so far over into the emphasis on feeling that it would ever become indulgent or actually watering the feelings. You know what I mean? Getting down and they're like, oh, I was sad. I kind of like that. I want to really be sad. You know, that I'm actually feeding that, because mindfulness, of course, is to not feed nor to push away. And because we're so good at pushing away, we have to emphasize the let it in, feel it, let it in, feel it. But you're right. The Skanda model, which I just alluded to, that's an entirely different talk, but we have a whole range of consciousness. And we're so good at living in number five, we're very, very easy to forget 4, 3, 2, and 1. So the emphasis on being aware, oh, part of the range of my experience as a human is cloth against skin, and the fact that I'm still sad about somebody who died 10 years ago and about Fawn, and I'm really excited about today, I get to see my sister, da, 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 da. Because those things are usually blind to me, or they're kind of, my awareness of them isn't complete, I forget how quickly number five can act as a defense against the others and kind of take over. It's kind of the ego hijack thing that you're talking about. Does that make sense? It's a great question, because yeah, we can start using this practice, any practice, can get hijacked by ego for its own ends, and we start doing the bypass that I was talking about, like, oh yes, I'm really, really spiritual because I've got lots of deep emotions. Or the opposite. I'm really, really spiritual because I have none at all. Nothing gets to me. You know? And it's like, oh, realizing there's something sticky going on there in both of those cases, and how quickly we can use something like Dharma to our own ends. And when I say own ends, I'm just trying, we're talking about just something I'm scared of, right? I don't want to feel anything because I'm scared. And if feeling a whole bunch makes me more spiritual, oh, then I want to do that. Well, what are you scared of? Oh, I'm afraid of not being spiritual. Right? So I know there's way more we could talk about that, but that's a great question, Dean. Was that at all helpful?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Raymond, I'm going to turn it over to you because I know we have announcements. But thank you, everybody, very much for your attention this morning.
Enjoy your tea.